Today is Thursday, November 22nd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, the UN envoy arrives in Yemen as an international aid group warns of an astronomical humanitarian crisis.
The UN is warning now that Yemen is at risk of the worst famine in 100 years, with 14 million people on the brink of starvation, including millions of children.
President Trump picks a fight with the Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court. On the day Americans give thanks, some are serving up meals to military families. Also ahead, a popular female pop star has just released a hot new single. It's all on today's International Edition. An estimated 85,000 children under the age of five may have died from extreme hunger in Yemen since a Saudi-led coalition intervened in the civil war in that country in 2015. The disturbing just-released statistics from international aid organization Save the Children come as UN envoy or special envoy Martin Griffiths arrives in Yemen to pursue peace talks as Western countries press for a ceasefire that will end the disastrous four-year conflict. Save the Children says the war has unleashed the world's most urgent humanitarian crisis, with 8.5 million people believed to be on the verge of starvation. Save the Children blames the widespread starvation on a Saudi-led blockade that was tightened a year ago after the Iran-aligned rebels fired a ballistic missile at the Saudi capital of Riyadh. VOA's Victor Beatty spoke with Emily Clifton, Associate Director for Humanitarian Response with Save the Children, about how they came to these astounding and horrific numbers.
We know now that 1.3 million children under the age of five needed treatment for severe acute malnutrition over the last 3 years. And using data compiled by the UN, we took the total number of children that were not reached with medical care. And that 85,000 figure is the total number of children we expect have died from severe acute malnutrition and complications based on an average mortality rate derived from four historical studies. But in all likelihood, this is a conservative estimate, and the number of children who have died could actually be much higher.
And, of course, you can extrapolate that the number of people who are in need of just basic food is in the millions.
Absolutely. The UN is warning now that Yemen is at risk of the worst famine in 100 years, with 14 million people on the brink of starvation, including millions of children. And it's important to highlight that children who die from severe acute malnutrition suffer immensely. Their vital organ functions are slowing down and eventually stop. Their immune systems are so weak that they are more prone to infections, and many become too frail to even cry. Their parents are witnessing their children waste away in front of them, unable to do anything about it. It's a really terrible situation, and these deaths are entirely preventable.
So the news that the UN is hoping to forge a peace process in Sweden early in December comes as good news.
Yes. Save the Children is calling on all sides and the international community to find a peaceful solution to this war and to work towards stabilizing the economy to help people be able to afford to meet their basic needs again and to allow complete and unconditional access for humanitarian aid and commercial goods into Yemen.
Some of the recent fighting in this four-year conflict is centered around the port city of Hodeidah, where most of the supplies are coming in. So this is also a significant turning point, if you will, in the peace process.
Yes, we are seeing that over the past year and especially the past few months, access is increasingly restricted to the country. And even before this crisis, Yemen depended on the majority of their food was through imports. And we're seeing that in the past year that the levels of imports have gone down dramatically. On average, there are about 55,000 metric tons less of food being imported per month, which would be enough to meet the needs of 4.4 million people.
If the conflict is ending, or at least some sort of a truce is forged, what would it allow groups like Save the Children to do to increase the reach to those who most are in need?
Yes, being able to have unrestricted access to reach the most vulnerable people and children in need of services would be a huge help in our efforts, and especially to be able to reach these children with severe acute malnutrition who need care so desperately. We are on the ground, and they're providing medical treatment through mobile health clinics, malnutrition treatment, trying to keep children in school, and providing protection activities and food vouchers for families to be able to meet their needs as well.
Emily, for those who hear this, so what would be the most important thing that people could do to help groups like Save the Children ease the plight of these children?
Sure. For anyone who would like to learn more about this crisis and the work that Save the Children is doing on the ground, I would encourage them to go to savethechildren.org/Yemen.
All right, that's Emily Clifton, Associate Director for Humanitarian Response with international aid organization Save the Children. U.S. Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, John Roberts, defended the independence of the federal judiciary on Wednesday, a day after President Donald Trump called a judge who ruled against his policy barring asylum for certain immigrants an Obama judge. But Trump rejected the rebuke, chiding Roberts and launching a new round of attacks. Here's the president's initial comments that led the Chief Justice to speak out.
The Ninth Circuit, we're going to have to look at that. Because every case, no matter where it is, they file it practically. I mean practically, for all intents and purposes. They file it in what's called the Ninth Circuit. This was an Obama judge. And I'll tell you what, it's not going to happen like this anymore.
Roberts, in his first public response to Trump, was similar to what opponents of the president have said about his persistent criticism of the courts and judges, issued a statement saying, quote, "We do not have Obama judges or Trump judges, Bush judges or Clinton judges." Roberts, a conservative who was appointed by Republican former President George W. Bush, said in a statement released by the Supreme Court in response to a news media inquiry, quote, "What we have is an extraordinary group of dedicated judges doing their level best to do equal right to those appearing before them. That independent judiciary is something we should all be thankful for." Roberts added in the statement, which did not mention Trump by name. But in a Twitter post, Trump responded saying, quote, "Sorry, Chief Justice John Roberts, but you do indeed have Obama judges, and they have a much different point of view than the people who are charged with the safety of our country." Critics say Trump's comments are an attack on the rule of law in the United States. The United States Constitution established the federal judiciary as a co-equal branch of government, with the executive and legislative branches as part of a system of checks and balances on power. Joining us now to discuss is Robert Deitz, professor of governmental affairs at George Mason University. What is your reaction to all that's been happening?
Chief justices, justices generally don't make this kind of commentary on political issues. At the same time, presidents don't make the kinds of statements about federal judges or any other kind of judge, for that matter, as a matter of course. And so I think what Chief Justice Roberts was doing was kind of firing a shot across the bow. I'm not going to allow my branch of government to come under foolish political attacks from the executive branch of government. And believe me, I'm here for life. You're not. And it probably would behoove you to demonstrate a little respect for the third branch of government.
After the Chief Justice made the statement, Trump basically went back after the justice and said, "Sorry, Chief Justice, but you do indeed have Obama judges."
Justices, federal judges, state court judges, judges of any merit are not, is political animals. I have never heard of a justice or a judge, when faced with a case, say, "Now let's see, what would the president want me to do," mm-hmm. since he appointed me, you know, he's a Democrat or Republican. What would he want me to do? I cannot truly imagine that thought process go through a justice's mind, even one who tends to be quite political.
Right.
I can't imagine that even being a part part of the inquiry.
It seems that every time a ruling doesn't go in his administration's favor,
yes,
he just goes on the attack of whoever is responsible, whatever judge or justice that may be.
Yes.
In fact, Roberts himself, back when President Obama was in 2012 in particular, when the Supreme Court preserved President Obama's signature domestic policy, of course, the Affordable Care Act,
yes,
Trump tweeted, "Congratulations, John Roberts, for making Americans hate the Supreme Court."
Right.
That's unreal, but he wasn't president then.
Right. It's really, I think all of us who care about, you know, democracy, care about this country, ought to be concerned that a president seems to work so hard to undermine the faith that the country invests in its three branches of government. Because it's really almost an accusation of corruption. I don't mean corruption in the sense of money passing hands, but I mean the notion that anybody, and particularly a president, thinks that judicial cases are decided because of the personal predilections of justices, or that they would do something because the president who appointed them wants that thing to be done, is such a wrong interpretation of how our system of government works.
We have heard the president in recent days go on the attack against a very high-profile senior military member who
yes,
is responsible for the capture and killing of Osama bin Laden. We
and is
have
enormously well-respected by, you know, across the board.
Right. And someone pointed out we've heard the president go after his Central Intelligence
yep,
Agency. We've heard the president go after high-ranking military members. We've now heard him, you know, going on the defense with the Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court. And yet we haven't heard him really say anything negative to Saudi Arabia,
right,
who is potentially responsible for the murder of a U.S.-based journalist.
No, absolutely. But, you know, I can't help thinking that at some point, even his most loyal supporters aren't at some point going to say, wait a minute, this is nuts. This man is just babbling, that he doesn't know what he's talking about, he speaks from ignorance, and that this is not the kind of person we ought to be entrusting our democratic values with, is absolutely an idiot. He doesn't understand how government works. He doesn't understand sort of proper democratic values.
The president a while back made a statement that he was very upset that he wasn't able to have a say or input into the inner workings of the Justice Department and the FBI. Does that sort of give you a signal that he doesn't understand the fundamental
yes, absolutely,
of our Constitution and
yes,
how our justice system works?
Yes, and I believe that is actually true. Part of what makes our government strong is our institutional system with three branches of government. And for him to act as though the Department of Justice, you know, this magnificent institution, is his own private law firm to do his bidding, as though he were, you know, back in the private sector and he would say to a lawyer, look, I want you to sue somebody. The lawyer would say, oh, yeah, sure, you're paying my bills, no problem. And the fact that he seems to feel that way, I mean, really believe it, such a misguided understanding of how our government system works, has to be almost breathtaking.
That's Robert Deitz, professor of governmental affairs at George Mason University. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. The Afghan government will step up operations against militants. The White House approves the use of force by troops at the border. Myanmar court has allowed jailed journalists to appeal their convictions. And lack of money and status prevent refugees in Kenya from getting clean energy. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. A testy meeting of world leaders in Papua New Guinea failed to agree Sunday on a final communique, highlighting widening divisions between global powers, China and the U.S. The 21 nations at the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation, also known as Summit, as the summit struggled to bridge differences on the role of the World Trade Organization, which governs international trade. A statement was to be used or issued instead by the meeting's chair, Papua New Guinea Prime Minister Peter O'Neill, who said the entire world is worried about tensions between China and the U.S. He told a mob of reporters that surrounded him after he confirmed there was no communique from leaders.
APEC leaders continue to focus on the efforts about trying to reduce inequalities, focus on making sure there is economic diversification, and working together so that we can remove trade barriers, so that we can drive growth and ensuring prosperity for our people.
It was the first time leaders had failed to agree on a declaration in 29 years of the Pacific Rim summits that involve countries representing 60% of the world economy. Draft versions of the communique seen by the Associated Press showed the U.S. wanted strong language against unfair trade practices that it accuses China of. China, meanwhile, wanted a reaffirmation of opposition to protectionism and unilateralism that it says the U.S. is engaging in. The U.S. has imposed additional tariffs of $250 billion on Chinese goods this year over Chinese trade practices. And Beijing has retaliated with its own tariffs on American exports. VOA Asia's Ira Melman asks Phil Levy, senior fellow on the global economy at the Chicago Council on Global Affairs, what APEC's inability or unwillingness to reach an accord will mean to the upcoming G20 meeting in Buenos Aires, where U.S. President Trump and Chinese leader Xi are expected to meet.
It did not seem like a diplomatic success, and it also did not seem like it was setting the stage for any quick resolution of the conflict between the United States and China. If anything, Vice President Pence, who had a long career as a free trader, has seemed to be the voice of entrenched opposition to China.
Why do you think that is? That was that set up that way, that he went instead of Trump? Is there an intentional move, as far as you are concerned, about taking a very strong sense against China? And how is China reacting to that?
Presidents like to show up when they think there's going to be some, you know, glory to be reaped from this. And that clearly was not the case with APEC, that this was going to be conflict and, you know, being chastised by someone. And if you're president, that's when you think, I'll send the vice president in my stead. I think what we're seeing here is, particularly in the approach that Vice President Pence has taken, you're not only getting the litany of economic complaints about China, but they're also getting tinged with serious national security concerns. The important point about that is it's going to make it very hard for this administration to reverse course with any speed.
Is that not the case for China, as their very strong sense by Xi Jinping? Is it not almost the same situation?
Well, I think one of the ways to interpret China's reaction to all this was those who had hypothesized that China would be vulnerable, that China's economy was shaky, that China was going to be desperate to have a quick resolution, were probably disabused of that notion, that you cannot slap China in the face like this and expect them to simply surrender. They didn't. They took a strong stand. They tried to claim the high ground as the defender of the multilateral trading system. There's a fair bit of irony in that. But rhetorically, it puts them in a somewhat stronger position given the attacks on the system that the Trump administration has put forward.
Now, we move on to the next coming weeks when the meeting between Trump and Xi is at least scheduled on the sidelines in Buenos Aires. How do you think this prelude to that meeting will affect that meeting?
I certainly don't think the results of APEC bode well. Ideally, if you are going to have a successful summit between heads of state, you have months at least of background work by lower level officials that would not usually be at the vice presidential level, but lower still, who are working out all the details, teeing everything up, and leaving a few key issues to be resolved. As far as I know, there are some meetings that are starting to happen, but we haven't seen the kind of preparatory work that usually will lead to a successful summit, even if we were talking about relatively mundane issues. And the kind of things on the agenda between the U.S. and China are not mundane, nor are they easy.
So what kind of pitfalls does that raise?
It means that you could have a repeat of the G20 of the kind of conflict that we saw at APEC, where it's not open hostility, of course, but it's kind of chilly.
So what happens now? What happens if your assessment and your prediction of the possibility of the meeting in Buenos Aires to end up like APEC, where does it leave the situation?
Well, this would be China sort of calling President Trump's bluff, perhaps, that the president has kind of hinted to farmers and others who are suffering from Chinese retaliation that a deal is around the corner, the end is in sight, don't worry, hang on, you'll sell those crops after all. If you don't have a deal, I don't think soybean crops can sit forever in the fields or in the silos. And meanwhile, the president has committed $200 billion of imports from China from 10% to 25% as of January 1st, and that's coming up soon.
That's Phil Levy, Senior Fellow on the Global Economy at the Chicago Council of Global Affairs, joining VOA's Ira Melman by Skype. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
It's the weekend, and whatever you're doing, you could use a little extra love. Music love, that is. Hello, this is Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa, and I've got the perfect weekend show for you.
I just called to say I love you.
First, over 30 minutes of the continent's best pan-African music, commercial-free. Second, Song of the Week, Janjo by Daju. And then two exclusive interviews with artist Soul Prayer from Harare, Zimbabwe, and Free Boy from Kano, Nigeria.
Anywhere I go, I am the number one.
It's your boy, Free Boy Sunny, DJ Blondo on the beat, do my record.
So lots of music love coming your way. Don't miss it. Music Time in Africa, this Sunday, 5 minutes past the hours of 15 and 2000 UTC.
VOA's International Edition continues. Well, through its nonprofit's annual holiday meals for military program, Operation Homefront delivers or distributes Thanksgiving meals to military families in the Washington, D.C. area every year. They've given away hundreds of thousands of meals since the program started. VOA's Miriama Diallo was there as this year's families received their holiday meals.
400 boxes filled with goodies to help celebrate this year's Thanksgiving holiday.
Happy Thanksgiving!
Vivian Dittrich is a senior director for Operation Homefront's Mid-Atlantic region.
We're celebrating this giving of thanks here at Thanksgiving by providing a holiday meal to our military families, and each family is getting a fully prepared Thanksgiving dinner from Harris Teeter, MillerCoors, and Jackson Family Wine. They're working together to help us sponsor this meal.
In the boxes, some cranberry sauce, mashed potatoes, green bean casserole, and more to go with the traditional turkey meal. But more than just food, it's an opportunity for families to spend some quality time together, says Brigadier General Aaron Dean II of the D.C. National Guard.
Thanksgiving baskets represent the opportunity for you to bring your families closer together, a chance for you to get with your family and share a meal, conversation, camaraderie, and the sense of family and the sense of belonging in that day we call Thanksgiving.
His wife, Laura Dean, says although she doesn't wear the uniform, as a military spouse, she's thankful for what her husband and others have given up over the years.
They give their lives, they sacrifice a lot for us. And when they do that, they're sacrificing several things with their families. They miss birthdays, they miss holidays, they miss promotions. They miss a lot of things with their own families just so that they can give the citizens of this country the freedoms.
Sergeant Jonathan Hune has been serving in the military for 16 years. He attended with his daughter.
We're real grateful for everything that happens when stuff like this happens for us because it's hard on families. It's hard being away from our families and just knowing that we have all the support behind us here, just in our communities and everywhere. Supporting the military is a great honor.
Specialist Daniel Jones brought his four sons with him.
I'm thankful to everyone who acknowledges, and my children are grateful as well because they get to see that there are people that care.
But as for who's going to help Daddy in the kitchen on Thanksgiving Day,
I'm going to let him cook it on his own. I'm going to just eat it all.
I want to help my dad make the macaroni and cheese. I'll try to help my dad.
I wouldn't help because my dad doesn't like that many people in the kitchen because that's how he gets it done faster.
Safety first. I show him some things, but I try to keep the kitchen clear.
In Washington, Mariama Diallo, VOA News.
Happy Thanksgiving. One of the most popular female singers has just released a very successful new single from a hit album. VOA Border Crossings host Larry London joins International Edition Sarah Williams with all the details.
Well, today we've got the brand new song from Ariana Grande, which is off of her Sweetener album. It's called Thank You, Next. A lot of people believe that the song is the result of the failed relationship she recently had with Pete Davidson, who's a comedian actor from Saturday Night Live on NBC television here in the United States. But she won't confirm or deny that report. But the song is so good that it's gone to number one, and it's been number one for 2 weeks. The fastest number one debut since 2015 when Adele was number one. There are only six female singers who have debuted at number one. And so Ariana Grande is in elite company. So let's check out the new song. It's called Thank You, Next.
I read somewhere on the internet that maybe she had tweeted about she'd had some hard times recently.
Well, yeah. I mean, the whole world is aware of the hard times she's had. First of all, she performed in Manchester last May, a year plus, and people lost their lives because after her concert at the Manchester Arena, a suicide bomber blew himself up and took a number of lives, injured a number of other folks. That was devastating to her. She went into depression. She still suffers anxiety and loses a lot of sleep over that. It's something that affected her deeply. Then, this past year, her boyfriend, ex-boyfriend at the time, Mac Miller, took his own life. So she had those things to deal with while putting out a brand new album called Sweetener, and recently got engaged, all within a month of dating Pete Davidson. And then it ended all within 2 months. So it didn't really last. Probably wasn't meant to last from the beginning. Problem is, when you're young like Ariana is, you get a tattoo with your future husband's name. And what do you do after it ends? You know, that's what she's been dealing with. She covered it up with a Band-Aid once. She then had something written over the tattoo she had gotten. Another way she's dealing with her anxiety and depression, she cut her hair, which is kind of interesting for Ariana because she's famous for having a ponytail,
right,
which she's had for a number of years since she appeared on a children's show on Nickelodeon TV. So she's cut her hair. It's short, no more ponytail. But she's going out on tour. This album is doing very well. She's had quite a few. God Is a Woman, No Tears Left to Cry, Breathe. And these are songs she's already had hits with. Now the latest at number one, Thank You, Next, is out. And so she's going on the road with Normani Corday, formerly of Fifth Harmony. So it's going to be a great tour. Ariana is definitely one of the artists to watch right now. She's very, very popular in the mainstream and currently on the charts doing well with her new album, Sweetener.
Well, it seems because of that and her new tour, she's got a lot to feel good about.
She does. Well, hopefully she's feeling good enough to hold it all together and keep the proper perspective. There are people close to her that say that she's not been herself lately, so you know, she's got a lot of support. She loves her fans. And hopefully, you keep reading today where people like Demi Lovato, Selena Gomez, these stars in the mainstream are dealing with the pressures of being famous. And hopefully Ariana keeps it together, keeps focused, you know, on the future and how bright things are looking for her in the future.
Thanks a lot, Larry. That's Larry London. He's the host of VOA's Border Crossings.
You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thank you so much for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, John Ellison. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.